You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got Tebow. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, the full crew, Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
Neil Payne, sports writer at 538.
What's up?
How you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
Good.
Really good.
Guys, I'm not going to be here the next couple weeks.
That's right.
I know you're vacationing again.
Again, yeah.
Vacation shaming.
You're going to be so far away that you will have no chance to watch the Mets playoff run until the World Series. Is that right?
As I've explained to you before, Neil, I booked a trip in April with the express purpose of ensuring that the Mets would make the playoffs by not being
by
here
not
to witness it. Right.
Right.
And so there seems to be a pretty clear correlation, sample size or no, or small sample size or no, it doesn't matter to me, between me leaving and the Mets making it. So I plan to move out of America to ensure a dynasty, a Mets
reverse
dynasty.
Jinx.
Is this the first time this has happened, or do you have other statistical evidence of like a previous year?
I've been here for the last, I have been on this earth for the last 29 years,
okay.
And the Mets have not been to the World Series since. 86, let me think about that. In 86,
yeah.
I was 2 months old.
They went to the World Series in 2000.
You're right. So you just busted
I'm just saying, there was not a lot of validity in it to begin with. So
I blacked out that 2000 World Series, Neil. That was really impressive. In my head, it had not been since 86.
Did not happen.
Okay, so on today's show, we're not going to talk about the Mets the whole time, shockingly. We are going to talk about the baseball playoffs and whether the wild card game needs fixing. We're going to talk about the WNBA's finals, Maya Moore, and the shifting meaning of the analytical ideal, right? We're just going to talk about the analytical ideal.
Yeah.
That's so poetic.
Sounds so deep.
It's philosophical.
We're going to talk about the kick-pocalypse that visited the NFL over the weekend. Is it real? Is it here? Is it here to stay? But first, you know, here on Hot Takedown, we think that any hot taker should have the space to defend their own takes. And over the weekend, Trent Dilfer did just that, unwittingly, perhaps. He was doing some analysis on Sunday night on ESPN about the Giants-Bills game in the NFL, and he was trying to explain how the Bills had ruined their shot at winning through silly mistakes.
I'm giggling because it was a year ago, I think this week, that I saw Miami Reel, the most brilliant analysis I've ever given about, you know, you can't win in the NFL.
Tremendous.
Yeah, I'm reminded about it every day. It's fantastic stuff. I dropped knowledge on you guys that day. But I'm giggling because the point being, wish I would have said it differently, it's hard to win when you're just giving things away. You're giving freebies to the other team. You're giving first downs to the New York Giants, 7 of them, on penalties. You're basically saying we want this to be harder.
Well, that's good, but
that wouldn't
be
as good.
I know.
It's not as good.
Hey, just check my Twitter. Check my
winning
Twitter account or YouTube or anything if you want a rehash of a year ago. It was brilliant.
You know what?
I'm reminded about it every day. Do you think he's listening to the Hot Takedown theme every day? Is that why he just got it on his iPod?
So. Well, yeah, he must subscribe.
And he knows that Tim Tebow is a gamer also.
He's
just
a
listens
gamer
to the whole thing.
So do you guys, I mean, now that he's explicated a bit more his take, there's some validity and value in what he's saying, right? That teams can't win if they're going to.
Yeah. I mean, it's still not like.
He didn't make it super clear that he was saying that,
right,
first of all.
I mean, one, I kind of always felt, or I feel bad for anyone sometimes on TV when you didn't exactly mean what you said, and it's not like writing where you can go back and edit your sentence before you actually send it in. So he obviously had different thoughts in his head that did not get translated properly, but even the ones he shared just now on that hot take, like, yeah, of course in the NFL you can't like give up 7 first downs and expect to win. But, I mean, it's a little bit more of an insightful narrative than what we play on our theme.
Do you guys know about the Kinsley gaffe in politics and how, like, when a politician says it, something he's not supposed to say, a Kinsley gaffe is that he actually meant it and that's why he said it? You know, it's not a gaffe that he said the wrong thing. It's that he said the right thing, but you're not allowed to say the right thing. I feel like a great hot take it's like it's actually the purest distillation of of a simple thought, right? Expressed inartfully.
It's a Freudian take.
Freudian takedown. That's what this show is really all about. Okay, let's leave Dilfer behind and move on to baseball. Baseball playoffs are here. It's a beautiful time. October, autumn, the leaves falling, the grass shorn tight in the stadiums, people wearing scarves to go see their favorite team play.
Hot chocolate.
But is it all just a crapshoot? You drink hot chocolate at the stadium, Kate?
Yes.
You're a big believer in hot chocolate stadium. I never quite get it.
Yes.
Like the Dunkin' Donuts, you are in line, ready to go.
I was on Saturday at that Mets game. It was like about 35 degrees out there.
Yeah, and there's no like hot toddy usually at the stadium.
There's your business innovation.
That's true. I'm gonna
the bars like should start at the stadiums.
Cocktails that are hot there at Major League Baseball stadium, but only
seasonal,
during a couple months.
It's seasonal, right? Yeah, artisanal seasonal.
So for the Mets, it's going to become a booming business over the next.
Oh,
few
I'm
years.
Sure. Yeah.
Especially if I'm in India. So let's get back to the thread that we were talking about, which is about the baseball playoffs and what it takes to win. Here is Eduardo Perez on ESPN trying to explain, you know, what it takes, what the team chemistry and the team makeup needs to be in order to win.
Pitching, defense, and base running. Then you have to be able to catch the ball. I cannot have any errors at all running the bases. And if you get those three down, the hitting will come.
So what are you saying is you have to play well.
You cannot lose games in baseball and still hope to win.
So, Neil, I've worked at 538 long enough to absorb some semblance of a truism, which is that almost every playoffs and almost every sport are a crapshoot, and baseball seems especially a crapshoot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's fair to say that, you know, like NBA playoffs are on the same level as something like hockey. But definitely baseball is one of the more random playoffs, it seems. And it's because there's just like not enough of a gap, I think, in any one game between the better team and the lesser team, especially when you're talking about the playoffs, which is by definition very evenly matched teams, to really get a reliable sample to judge teams on. You know, you're not finding the better team most of the time, even in like a best of seven baseball series.
Yeah, because like in the NBA playoffs, there's nothing we talk about where it's like, well, now you know it's going to come down to the center, or now it's going to come down to the point guard. It's still, as the NBA playoffs move forward, and we tend to think of them as the quote-unquote most fair playoff, it's still just, is that team going to play the way they play it during the regular season? Where with hockey, all of a sudden there's this huge dependence on goalie. And in baseball, it's kind of like, well, do you have the number one starter who, when the days line up right, all of a sudden statistically you seem to have a better chance? It's not the same exact parallel between what you need out of the regular season.
That's why what Perez was saying about base running and fielding, whatever, that seems like totally alien to what I feel when I watch. And when I watch baseball now, what's thrilling to me is because it's so random, I really have no idea what's going to happen. And for a while, I was sort of on the other side of it, which was that, well, if it's all random, then the best team isn't winning, and then there's some like imperfection within baseball playoffs. But maybe that the best team doesn't always win is the perfection, right? That there is so much unpredictability. And I've really come around to that. And weirdly, looking at the analytics and the sabermetrics has helped me become even more attached to the chaos and the randomness within the sport.
Yeah, because, playoffs are marketed across the board as kind of like this exciting, unpredictable time. And so for baseball to, in some ways, capitalize on that emotion just plays into the whole point of why we're all watching sports to begin with, that we certainly capitalize on with March Madness, college football playoffs. Like, in a way, it's not that fun if you're like, well, you know, the Blue Jays are the best team, and then therefore 92% chance they're going to win. You're kind of just tuning in to make sure that thing happens. That's not what we want to see either.
Yeah, it's kind of the best formula for the playoffs is to have that uncertainty in it, because it causes people, I mean, you don't want to have so much uncertainty that it feels like, oh, the 162 games that we just played mean nothing.
That's what college basketball does, and that seems to work out okay.
Yeah, it works out well. I think mean, for someone like me, just personally, my opinion of March Madness, the more random and chaotic I've kind of like understood it to be, has made me sort of lose interest. But maybe that's something endemic to college basketball, where like it's not the same players every year also, and there's something
about
that.
What we're saying is chaos is marketable up until a certain point.
Right.
And I always thought that the NFL found sort of the perfect sweet spot of that, where, you know, the games during the season mean something, but there's also that element of randomness. And then once you get into the playoffs, you feel like there was a mystery. I think in baseball, there's less mystery about who really is good and bad during the regular season because they play so many games. But then that mystery is undone in the playoffs because you see teams that you just had this huge sample of games to know that they probably weren't as good kind of winning. Whereas in football, I think you have that mystery where you can kind of convince yourself, oh, well, maybe the Giants were the best team in 2007, you know, and maybe, you know, all of those things. But I think baseball is closer to that ideal that football has found than something like March Madness.
We're not talking about analytical ideals yet. That's for the next segment, Neil. So let's talk about this year's playoffs. Who's good? Who's bad? Neil, I've seen the sparks come flying out of your desk as you solder together a new model. Please don't tell me it's another ELO model.
It is another ELO model.
We love ELO
around here.
Yes. Okay, so for the listeners who have not, who have fast-forwarded through all talk of ELO in the past, tell them what ELO is and how it works in baseball.
Well, I can't imagine they wouldn't fast-forward through this as well, but ELO is a system that we use to sort of judge how good a team is at any given moment, and it's a pretty simple system. It was invented to judge chess players, actually, and it's just based on, like, giving a team a rating and then asking, well, what are the odds that each team wins? And if the result is expected according to those pregame odds, then you're like, well, those odds were probably right and we don't have to make many adjustments to them. But if the result of the game really contradicts what your ratings were going into the game, then the ratings are sort of like self-correcting. They're like, oh, well, we messed up.
So the Cliff Notes version is you go up if you win, you go down if you lose. If you lose unexpectedly, you go down big. 1,500 is the average. Neil, who's the best team in the major league?
The Blue Jays right now have the best ELO rating of any team, which is pretty amazing because they actually had a below average ELO rating on June 2nd, but they've had such a great second half, and also they picked up some players at the trade deadline. And ELO, one of the great things about it is it picks up on that and sort of you're able to play yourself to, if you have improved your talent level, you can kind of boost your rating by playing better, and it picks up on it really fast if you continue to win as they do. And another thing that stood out to me about the ELO ratings is that the second and third best teams in all of baseball, according to ELO, are the Pirates and Cubs, who are going to play in a one-game play-in for the right to play in the division series.
So I want to talk about wild card in a second, but Kate, sort of off the top of her head, said the Blue Jays have a 93% chance of making the playoffs, having looked at anything. Of winning the World Series. Neil, does ELO suggest that the Blue Jays have a 93% chance of winning the World Series? Did Kate, off the top of her head, get it exactly right to the number?
The Blue Jays won the World Series in 1993, but they don't have a 93% chance of winning.
Yeah, it was a Freudian take.
According to ELO, and it is a little bit more conservative than the betting markets about this, but not that much more. ELO says that there's a 19% chance that the Blue Jays will win the World Series. Right behind them are the Cardinals and Royals with 13% and the Dodgers with 12%. And those are the best teams in all of baseball.
Come on, for me and Kate.
And the Mets have a 9% chance of winning the World Series, a 20% chance of making the World Series. So these are all the compression of the ratings. They're very close to each other. So the Mets aren't really that much worse than even the Blue Jays if they had to play them.
But why over the second half of the season did the Blue Jays catapult to such a spot, whereas, you know, the Mets... Well, since Wilmer Flores cried, maybe later on in the season than just the second half, did not gain as many ELO points.
I think some of it is, like you said, the later start. I think their run differential probably wasn't as good as the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays were just like blowing people out, right and left. There was a stretch where the Mets were doing that too, but I think, you know, less consistently than the Jays. And also, strength of schedule matters. The NL East has had, you know, they've stacked a lot of games against the Marlins and against the Phillies and against a bunch of teams that are really bad, whereas the Blue Jays were, you know, in the mix with the Yankees and some of the other AL East team.
One quick thing about the Blue Jays run differential. I saw a piece on Fangraphs earlier today, I think it was by Jeff Sullivan, in which he charted the amount of time on offense versus on defense for Major League Baseball teams. The Blue Jays were so good on offense, they spent a full day, as in 24 hours, more time batting than they did pitching. Isn't that incredible? I thought that was a great little nugget.
That puts it into perspective.
So, Neil, I didn't hear you mention the Cubs and Pirates as having a high World Series win percentage. Is that because of this damn wild card one game playoff?
Yeah, it really is. According to Elo, they are the second and third best team in all of Major League Baseball. But they're
better than every other NL team.
Every other NL team. They're the two best teams in the NL. The Pirates are slightly ahead of the Cubs. And you know, the records sort of reflect that. The Cardinals, I think, had the better record, but it was just a few games, you know, over the Pirates. And the Cardinals sort of tailed off toward the end of the season, where the Cubs certainly picked up steam, and the Pirates just had a fantastic season. But they have been shoehorned into this one game in which Elo thinks that the Pirates have a 54% chance, and by definition, the Cubs have a 46% chance, and that really slices their odds of winning the World Series basically in half. They would have round about, you know, 14 to 16% chance each if they didn't have to play in this one game play in. But because they do, it's taken. Basically, we know that one of the three best teams in baseball will be dead and gone in a couple days.
Game.
Yeah, after one game.
So whoever wins, though, is probably going to be second
behind
the Blue Jays
yeah.
for their chance to win the World Series.
Right.
So these wild card games.
Right.
We just got done talking about how random baseball playoffs are, and that's the whole baseball playoffs season, right? That's all of October. One game is like making that randomness and then bring it to a power of 16, because there's, you know, or how 11, I guess, because you need 11 wins to win. I think that.
Yeah,
right?
I can't even imagine what that feels like for those players who, you know, have been in spring training since what, February, to cut it down to, after building up so much rhythm and hopefully like proving what your team's capable of, and then taking all of that into one small sample size.
Yeah, I mean, so I think it depends kind of how you look at it.
If you win or lose, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Well, also, yeah, it depends on whether you win or lose, but also, like, whether you really had this mindset of, like, okay, we're in the playoffs now, this is distinct from the regular season, and now we have this chance to sort of play ourselves in and anything can happen, then it is kind of disappointing and it feels unfair to be thrust into this situation. But there are also, think about, like, every baseball season there are cases where late in the actual regular season you have a set of games that you need to win, and sometimes it even comes down to like one win that you know that you need to get. And
but that's part of a continuum.
But yeah, but it's all part of a larger 100.
Right.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, sure, every game can be pivotal or not pivotal, but this is the league and its rules saying this has to be pivotal. And that seems, and for many teams, and maybe this is fair, maybe this is not, the rotations are out of whack because they've needed to fight for that wild card position, and so they aren't able to start their best starter. So the quality on the field, you might be seeing a number four starter or something. I guess Dallas Keuchel, I guess, is the number one starter for the Astros, but in other years, we haven't seen the best pitcher go. And so it's not even the best product for baseball to be putting out there.
Well, I think in some ways, even if you start your best pitcher and it is a built-in disadvantage for the next series, because then now you've already burned through, you have to turn around and within 1 or 2 days start your next series of the actual division series, which used to be the playoffs, so to speak. And you have now lost your ace for that. So, you know, there's a lot of ways in which it could be construed as unfair, and I think a lot of it, we as fans do benefit because – you know, Major League Baseball looked at situations where the season came down to like one game and they had to play a tiebreaker after the regular season. And those were really exciting. There was that moment in 2011 where the Red Sox, you know, came down to the end and culminated their collapse in the last day of the season. And those things playing out in real time were so exciting that I think baseball was just like, why don't we do this every year?
Right.
And that's good, I think. It reduces the chance, because of the ace factor that I mentioned, of one of these wild card teams, you know, reeling off wins in the next few series. And so I think it serves to help teams that are considered the favorites and kind of played better and earned it during the regular season. But they still get a chance to get in, and it gives one extra team or in each league a chance to do something.
So I wanted to talk about how to fix the wild card game, or whether it should be fixed. Neil, I'm hearing from you. Maybe it shouldn't. But I don't think we have time for it. So, listeners, in the proud tradition of you guys fixing the NBA draft lottery. Walt Hickey's Madden career. Now fix the MLB wildcard game if you think it needs fixing.
Also, the language around Dynasty.
Yes, that's right.
I know that
we right.
fixed it, but we certainly solicited
the Cleveland.
Responses. Yeah.
Write in, podcast@538.com. We'd love to hear from you. All right, on to the WNBA, where the Indiana Fever, as of this taping, hold a 1-0 lead in the WNBA Finals over the Minnesota Lynx. In Game 1, it was a taut affair. It was down to the final possession, basically, when Lynx swingwoman guard forward. We were sort of
superstar.
trying to figure out what to classify her as.
Should crowdsource that, too.
There you go. podcast@538.com. So Maya Moore had the ball stripped from her. In the final seconds, despite scoring 27 points, the Fever went on to win. The Lynx lost. But it got us thinking about Maya Moore and sort of where to classify her in the WNBA annals of players. Is she one of the best of all time? Neil, I know that you and Basketball Reference have had a deep relationship about Maya Moore over the last little bit. But first, Kate, you said you spent time with her in China before that we were taking the show. Is that right?
Yeah, I spent time with her in China for a Brittany Griner documentary, but Maya also plays over there, along with more and more WNBA stars, because the China League is shorter, and they pay a good amount of money. And, of course, a lot of these players like the fact that they get home before the WNBA starts. But the point with the Maya Moore is that in China, those teams are only allowed to have one non-Asian player, unlike Russia and Turkey, where, you know, like Diana Taurasi and Sue Bird can play together. And in thinking about Maya Moore, especially this year, and her usage rate, and when combined with the fact that Lindsay Whalen, like a national team player, one of the best players in the league, hasn't been playing quite as much, especially I think the last game she didn't play like the last 6 or 7 minutes. So Maya has shared a lot of that burden. And in watching her play over in China, her usage rate, I mean, they don't keep this stat in China, but I think it would be incredibly, incredibly high.
Well, in the WNBA, her usage rate is incredibly high. Mm-hmm. Last year, in 2014, she was number one in the league, and this year, number two in the league. And so it seems as though the team is geared around her in a different way than the Fever are showing, because in the Fever, none of their players were in the top 10 of usage rate this year. And so there are two different strategies at play.
Yeah, the Lynx are obviously built to have a high usage rate around Maya Moore, and they're built around Maya Moore. And a lot of the other players, like Simone Augustus and Sylvia Fowles, more post players, Sylvia especially, Simone not quite as much, but also, you know, a big inside player. They have to rely on Maya's ability to create her own shot, which is something she's always done since her UConn days, versus the Fever. They have a player kind of like that in Catchings, who's a little bit older, 36, but they have a lot of really fast guards, and they just play a completely different style. And since the Lynx drafted Maya, like, the whole point has been you have arguably someone who could be considered the best player in WNBA history when it's all said and done, and that style of play is completely driven around her.
Yeah, they have the Lynx really, with Maya Moore's 30.5% usage, which is super high, like you're saying, Chad. They don't have that many other players who are capable of putting up that kind of usage anywhere near there. They only have four players over 20%, whereas Indiana has six players over 20%.
Kate mentioned that Moore was maybe going to finish as one of the best players of all time. Neil, when you were, I think you were looking at PER, which is player efficiency rating, for the WNBA, is she within that spitting distance?
Oh, sure. Yeah, if you look at the all-time career leaders, first of all, you got to give props to Cynthia Cooper, who was one of the great players in the first few seasons of the WNBA, and she had been a great college player and you know, didn't really have a chance to play in the U.S. professionally because there really wasn't much. The WNBA only started existence when she was, you know, sort of past her prime, and she still dominated. She's the all-time leader in PER. She's also the all-time leader in win shares per 48 minutes, and it's not even close. But and we had talked about this, I think, about women's college basketball, like the evolution of the game and the increased, you know, level of talent makes it harder for players to dominate the way that, you know, if you're a Cynthia Cooper drop down, you could. And so that's, I think it's a credit to Maya Moore that she's third all time in win shares per 48 minutes and fifth all time in PER, and is still sort of building on it. She's just now, you know, in her prime. So I think it's fair to say, right, Kate, that she could go down as the best ever, or one of the best ever, certainly, you know, already probably is one of the best ever.
Yeah, and her trajectory is to that space. And I think more so in women's basketball than men's, we kind of take into account how somebody performs at the college level, because unlike the NBA, the WNBA is not in the spotlight quite as much as the college game. So in these types of conversations, I would even more so lean also on the fact that Maya won three titles at UConn as the foundation for then her trajectory currently, which I don't know that I would feel that way if we were talking about, you know, best ever NBA player. I wouldn't be like, well, Michael Jordan also won at North Carolina. Like, I wouldn't even, that wouldn't entertain that thought.
Yeah, that's really interesting how when we, you know, the NBA, the Naismith Hall of Fame is actually a basketball Hall of Fame that does and is explicitly designed to take into account college stats and accomplishments and all of that. And some players, you know, like Bill Walton, I think, you know, benefits greatly from having, in addition to his kind of relatively short pro career, he won a championship. He also has all those UCLA accomplishments. But for most players, yeah, for like a Michael Jordan, we're not talking about the championship at UNC as part of his ring count, you know, that you would use to kind of ward off Kobe Bryant or LeBron James. And some of these guys, Kobe and LeBron, don't even have like a college career, mm-hmm. but it doesn't even matter. You know, all that matters is in the pros. But you're right. Like the WNBA, the college resume really, I think, does provide almost as much weight, you would think, as because the, you know, if you played at a UConn, you're having to kind of go through, you know, the gauntlet of players that you will face eventually in the WNBA also trying to win a college championship.
And it's often why people will pass over Cynthia Cooper in discussions of greatest ever is because I think she played at USC, but yeah, she kind of played in this era before mid-90s when the UConn made that undefeated run and they were on the cover of SI, which ushered in a little bit more of a media spotlight era to the women's game. She kind of fell into this a little bit of abyss in her college career and then had to play overseas before the WNBA launched right. for a number of years. And so she doesn't have that same name recognition among women's college basketball fans or quote-unquote basketball fans in general from her college days.
Right. It's kind of an interesting space to be in because, like, Cheryl Miller, for instance, didn't play in the WNBA, so it's all she has is her college career. But then Cynthia Cooper doesn't really have the benefit of the long pro career, but also, you know, the college career isn't separate and unto itself and in, like, distinctly another era.
So I want to shift the conversation a little bit away from Moore and to the links more generally and get to this analytical ideal thing that I was talking about earlier, which is we ran a piece on 538 by Ian Levy about how the strategy in the WNBA is quite different than in the NBA around three-pointers. And so in the NBA, you know, we've seen an explosion of teams taking corner threes, for example, because it's a high percentage shot. In the WNBA, the percentage that it the three is not as high percentage of a shot. And so teams are playing much more of a long two and post game. And the piece was sort of about how, you know, how different this analytical ideal, how different what good analytical strategy is in the same sport but in different circumstances within that sport. Kate, I know you had some thoughts about it.
Yeah, I had a lot of thoughts on this and three-point shooting in the WNBA coming from someone, me, whose three-point shooting was like the only reason I played college basketball was because I was quite good at that. And, you know, I was thinking about how while I was growing up, I only ever considered a three-pointer at the 19-9 level, because that's all it ever existed at for the women's game for when I was like, this is like late 90s, early 2000s. And there was the international FIBA distance, but high school was 19-9, college was 19-9 at that time, and the WNBA didn't exist mm-hmm. yet. And so unlike with the men's game where young players, I think, would know that there was the high school line, but they would also be like, NBA range. I mean, I certainly knew that there was NBA range, but there was at no point in my future projections was I thinking that I need to shoot a 23-foot three-pointer.
And to learn how to shoot.
And so when you actually consider how a lot of the players right now in the WNBA, where the line now has been moved to FIBA rules, which is 22 feet, like 1 3/4 inches, but grew up thinking 19-9 was all they knew. I mean, that's a significant change that they never even thought. So I think we are seeing right now a bit of a dip in three-point shooting percentages in the league. And I don't know if it comes from some of the shifts we've seen over the last like 3 to 5 years in these distances, but I think that's part of it. And it's also part of how we always make the parallel between where the WNBA is versus where the NBA was when it was 20 years into its progression. And I went back and looked at like the three-point percentages for the NBA about 20 years after they introduced the three-point line, and they took a significant dip. And I don't know exactly, like, theoretically why that might be, but they went from, like, like 16, 17 attempts a game to only like 12 or 13. And then they've been steadily building back up to where they are now. And I don't know if it's like if for when you're in that certain stage of growth, you have specialists. And then you get away from that into a completely well-rounded player. Like, there's less three-point specialists in the NBA than there probably were in the late 80s, right? Because now you have Steph Curry.
Did the NBA ever move their line back?
They did, yeah. They moved it closer and then moved it back to where it originally was in the mid to late 90s, I want to say.
Yeah. So just like, even Kyle Korver, who we thought was a specialist, kind of broke out of that shell and proved that he does different things. So it's kind of like the WNBA right now is in a little bit of a transition period about how it's going to use that three-point line.
Well, right. And it could be that you, players learn how to shoot the longer three. And there's so much efficiency to be exploited if you can shoot the three well, mm-hmm. that presumably there is a real opportunity for players coming up to be three-point specialists, the same that there is in the NBA now that the line is further away.
Right. And it might be one of those paradox of skill things where, like, the – you know, if it's early in the evolution of an idea or a strategy, the teams that are the early movers on it will be the ones that sort of reap the biggest benefits. But then the subsequent seasons will go by and everyone will kind of pick up on it and then they'll start doing it more. And then ironically, like, everyone will be good at this one thing. And maybe that's what we're seeing more in the NBA, because the NBA wide 3-point percentage, even from the longer distance, is, you know, it's 35%. And in the WNBA, it's 32.5%, but it's not like it's a difference in shooting ability necessarily, because on the women's side, the free throw percentage is a lot higher. It's 80%. In the NBA, it's only about 75%. So that also could be playing into it, because, you know, you're not going to get free throws typically. You know, you're not going to get fouled a lot if you're taking a lot of three-pointers, unless you're a James Harden type who also mixes up sort of drives at the basket. So it could just be also playing to the incentive of, you know, you want to be closer to the basket and draw more fouls because they're more efficient to shoot free throws in the WNBA.
Yeah, that's interesting, Neil, and I think we have to leave it there, but that the idea that that every sport, that the analytics revolution suggests that we have hard and fast truths, but the hard and fast truths are just as dependent on the rules as they are outside of sports. Right?
And what everyone else is doing.
Right, absolutely. Okay, one last thing, guys, on the WNBA. As I was researching this segment, I saw that there were 12 teams in the WNBA, only three of which end in S. So the Fever and the Lynx, they do not. Nine of the 12 teams.
The Liberty.
The Liberty, absolutely. The Sun, Dream. The Sky, the Dream. Here and in the four major men's sports leagues, nine teams total don't end in S.
What's your theory? Explain this.
So my theory, trust me, I have a theory. My theory is that it's a weird gender, that gender is baked into it, which is to say that for women's sports, we name women's teams as though they are one collective whole, as opposed to individual people who make up a whole, as there would be if a team ended in an S. So, you know, the Mets, for example, right? There are 25 Mets or whatever, yeah, that make up the Mets. And the Lynx and the Liberty and whoever else, they are a cohesive whole as is.
Now, couldn't it just also be that the WNBA is so new that all of the plural names were taken?
And when you look at expansion teams like the Magic and the NBA, for example, that's very possible. But come on, you can that pluralize anything.
I like it better when it's this whole one team gender,
right?
My reasoning. Yeah, my feminist dissertation is coming about the WNBA naming rituals. Okay, now let's really leave it there and move on to the kickpocalypse. The NFL moved back its extra point, of course, in the offseason. I think we talked about that on Hawk Takedown. Heading into week four, the NFL's field goal percentage was lower than it had been the year before, 75% instead of 84%. That actually has nothing to do with extra points. Then, in week four, what some are calling the kickpocalypse were upon us. 18 missed field goals and extra points combined in week four. I cannot think about kicking, guys, without thinking about Ben Morris, 538's other sports writer, the West Coast sports writer Beyond Neil. Ben Morris, making his Hot Takedown debut, is on the line from L.A. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
So, Ben, before we get started and you tell us whether the kickpocalypse is here, I want to read to you something that Peter King, the Sports Illustrated columnist, wrote this week about more missed field goals. I think the trend, and this is our hot take for this segment, I think the trend has to do with the youth at the position. 12 of 32 teams are using kickers in their first years with their teams, and the mental gain that the longer point after touchdown has forced kickers to deal with. Kickers are lottery tickets, You just pick one and pray. Ben, is it true that they are just lottery tickets?
Well, I mean, that's a different question than the apocalypse. I don't know. I mean, Justin Tucker is doing very well. There are 8 kickers so far that haven't missed any field goals this year. So I don't know if you would say that they're lottery tickets. I think he's very, very, very slightly right that kickers are doing a tiny bit worse this year than last year, but it's not by much. And I think the kickpocalypse this last weekend was, you know, not a great weekend for kickers, but for the season as a whole, their performance is still more or less in the range of expectation.
Yeah, I mean, is that a weekend like last weekend? That's something that probably has happened before, right, Ben? Like, even before the mental challenge of the extra point being moved back or whatever was true, right?
Yeah, there were worse weekends. I remember last weekend or last season there was a weekend in which the kickers missed a bunch of kicks, and I considered writing about it, and then it was just, it just seemed like variance. But I think this weekend it got a little more attention because a lot of them came kind of at very important times in games, like the New Orleans kick. They ended up winning the game anyway, but it came right at the end. That sort of thing. I think as far as a particular, like, one weekend phenomena, it's not particularly interesting. They missed some kicks, whatever. The season as a whole, I don't know the exact stat that Chad is referring to, but I have their numbers broken down here, and they're not really doing significantly. They're maybe a percent, like a weighted 1% behind last season, based on the length of the kicks they've been taking. And that varies a lot by distance. They seem to be doing extremely well at long distances. Actually, they're having record years at from 45 on, they're having the best season in the history of the sport. And then from, you know, like 40 to 45, they seem to have been struggling a bit. That's where they've missed 14 kicks of that distance is extremely high. And then below that, they're doing pretty well also. They've missed some extra points, but the extra points, they've been making almost exactly the same percentage as you would expect them to for a 33-yard kick.
Yeah, well, when the NFL moved back the extra point, like, statistically, what percentage were we expecting that to shift from, like, make expected percentage with it at one distance versus moving it back?
Well, at the old distance, they made 98% or something. At the new distance, just as far as 33-yard field goals go, they should be making somewhere in the range of 92-93%. But they're also 33-yard field goals right from the dead center of the field, and they have time and that sort of thing. So I've estimated that they should make that kick as much as 95-96% of the time, especially factoring in the fact that kickers tend to get better. And this year, so far, they've been making about 94%. So they're pretty much right in. They're slightly below my highest estimate, and they're slightly above the lower estimate.
So we've already disproved Peter King one way. Let's now do it the second way. Also, in that thing that I read, he said that the trend, which you've now suggested is not actually a trend, has to do with youth at the position. Ben, when I've read your stuff, especially, so you wrote a piece for 538 earlier this year called "Kickers Are Forever." That's about kickers getting better and better and better throughout all time in the NFL, and we can really see the development of a skill position that way. And what you've written about is that there's a new crop of kickers, rookies and recent entrants into the league that seem to be maybe some of the best kickers of all time, especially once you factor in how many they're making in the era that they're making. So it seems like King is off about the youth of the position too, right?
He seems way, way off on that one. I mean, even more so than the trend, which is at least visible. You can kind of understand it. I don't know where this youth thing is really coming from. There's one pretty bad rookie kicker this year is Kyle Brinza. He's missed 8 kicks this year, including, I believe, 2 extra points. So, he's not doing a particularly great job, although he's also made a bunch of, he made like 2 kicks of more than 55 yards. So it kind of reminds me of Greg Zuerlein. He seems to have a lot of leg, but he hasn't yet mastered consistency.
And Kyle Brinza just got released by the Buccaneers in the last day. The Buccaneers just released him.
Did he get released? Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say, if there's a candidate to be released, I was going to say it would be him rather than since Kobe, who was probably a bit of a quick release, in my view. But, yeah, Brinza's been pretty terrible. But aside from that, the young kickers are doing pretty – I mean, especially the ones that were a few years ago, like Justin Tucker is still the best kicker in the history of the league. Probably whether or not you wait for ERA, although there have been some good ones back in the day. Chandler Catanzaro is really good. He's a second-year player. Brendan McManus is probably – he has statistically the best season so far. He has yet to miss a kick, and he's made, I think, 4 field goals of over 50 yards, I want to say.
So, Ben, let me interrupt and just ask. So the one of the other things we were looking out for when the extra point was moved dozens of yards back was whether or not it would incentivize coaches to go for 2 more often. Have we seen any movement on that with the numbers? I don't know if you have those in front of you.
I don't have it in front of me. I looked at it last week, I guess. You've seen a small shift towards going for 2 more often, like with the Steelers. But overall, they do not seem to be responding to the math, especially if it settles down and kickers are making the extra point only like 94% of the time, which is sounds ridiculous. But if that's the case, then the math would suggest going for 2 kind of way more often. And that has definitely not been the case yet. But you've seen it a little bit. You know, they're on pace to have more 2-point attempts since the first year it was introduced, I think.
Okay, so Ben, when the next kickpocalypse is upon us, or at least discussion of the next kickpocalypse is upon us, what kind of guide would you give the average, you know, NFL consumer to survive it? How do you beat back these kind of short-term rushes to judgment? Should we just, you know, read your Kickers Are Forever piece by candlelight as a sort of mantra to remind ourselves that kickers are actually great?
Yeah, I mean, that helps. Or also just look
that's
at
what you do.
Breakdowns by distance. Just look at the breakdowns by distance, and you'll see that, you know, on Pro Football Reference is a very convenient page broken down by distance for the history of the NFL, and you can see that in 2015 as well, there are a couple distances that are doing a little bit worse, but overall, the numbers just get better and better and will likely continue to do so.
Well, Ben, one of the things I remember back like maybe 10 years ago when sort of football sabermetrics was just kind of being in the public eye at all, well, one of the things that people would put out there was like this idea that, oh, well, kickers are so random on field goals that they derive a lot of their value from sort of the hidden value of kickoffs. But that must be less true now than before, right, because they moved the kickoff distance and we're seeing a lot of touchbacks and everything. Do you have any sense of whether, like, the kickoff value is a lot less than it used to be, and so now it's kind of actually come back to the kickers just being able to flat out make field goals?
I mean, I think better kickers have made field goals more often, and it has a fairly significant impact on the game, so I guess I'd reject that theory in the first place. But yeah, I mean, I think the changing of the kickoff spot has definitely affected the math on that. I mean, it used to be a kicker could get you touchbacks regularly, had a fair amount of value from that alone, but that's extremely common now, so you don't have as much variance on that axis as far as kicker value.
All right, Ben, we're going to let you go. Good luck polishing your steel-toed boots. I know that, you know, someday you're still hoping to break into the kicker ranks yourself, but we'll talk to you next time.
I think I've never kicked a football, by the way.
Ooh, Ben. All right. That'll be our next stunt journalism project for you.
You bet.
All right, Ben, take care.
All right.
From one guest to another, but this guest is a regular. You know, she basically lives here. It's Allison McCann, a visual journalist at 538 here to bring us our significant digit, a telling number from the world of sports. Allison, welcome back.
Hey.
What have you brought us this week?
This week I have a significant digit that is near and dear to me. I've spent the last, which feels like forever, on this big NBA project that we have rolling out this week. And so the digit comes from that. It is 83.1, which is the total projected WAR over the next 7 years for Anthony Davis. And he is what our new big NBA, I guess, projections model that we're calling, nicknaming Carmelo. It's not just about Carmelo, but it says that Anthony Davis is the most valuable long-term commodity in the NBA.
Okay, so Carmelo looks at a current person and predicts their future based on what past people like them have done?
Correct. Carmelo stands for this crazy convoluted thing that I think Neil had some part in coming up with.
Career Arc Regression Model Estimator with Local Optimization. We took some liberties with the acronym a little bit. But
did you decide you wanted to name this model after Carmelo and you fit the language to be an acronym for Carmelo? Did you just start to notice Career Arc?
That's right. It was a
total coincidence. And you were like, oh, my God, let's fit this for Carmelo.
That it came out as being Carmelo. We didn't even think about it. It was clearly going to be a Career Arc Regression Model Estimator with Local Optimization.
Am I to believe this?
The whole time.
So to get back to Davis. So Carmelo says, what was it, 80-something win shares in 7 years? Sorry, 88 WAR in 7 years?
Yeah, 83.1 is his total projected WAR for the next 7 seasons.
And that's the best of anyone?
Yes,
More than LeBron.
Yes. If we look at all 7 years, in this year, LeBron is still above Davis. So is Steph Curry and James Harden. But over the long run, I guess we're calling him a long-term commodity, as Nate says.
Commodity.
That really doesn't feel creepy at all. Guys.
I'll talk to Nate about that. Okay, and so basically LeBron's old is what this also means, right?
Yeah.
And Davis is young.
Correct.
I'm assuming if I have like 10 different questions, I have to wait until this comes out.
Yep. Okay. Thursday.
You can ask one of the 10 questions.
What is Carmelo's war? Ooh.
Carmelo.
Within Carmelo.
Carmelo the model hates Carmelo the
oh, really?
Person.
Yes. So Carmelo the model is an ironic model?
Yes. He slowly drops towards 0.2 war in the final stages of his career. So Carmelo is not kind to Carmelo.
What's his overall war? Like over the next whatever it is.
It's around 4.3 right now, and it slowly gets lower.
Wow.
So if I had a ballpark, it's less than 10 in the next 7 years.
Compared to that 83 number, that is.
You
got to
get Carmelo on here to talk about Carmelo. About
I'm also Carmelo's wearing Carmelo's Carmelo. Right now.
Ooh. This is Carmelo to the fourth power.
I know. It's a lot.
Okay, Allison, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll do a proper segment on Carmelo at some point in the future. Not sure exactly when, but stay tuned and listen for that. And this week on 538, you can see the interactive model that Allison, as she said, has been putting so much work into for the last few weeks. So check that out. And two last programming notes before we go. First, for you baseball diehards, 538 is going to be live blogging the NL wildcard game between the Chicago Cubs and the Pittsburgh Pirates. I will be there pulling the strings on Wednesday night. Neil will be there writing feverishly as I lash him. Carl Bialik, who you've heard talk about tennis on Hot Takedown, will be there. Rob Arthur, 538's baseball columnist, will be there. Maybe Ben Lindbergh from Grantland. It should be fun.
All-star team.
Neil, you also have an announcement for those of our listeners who are in New York. Is that right?
Right, yeah. So I will be speaking alongside fellow 538er Walt Hickey.
His video game self or his actual self?
Possibly both, okay. Because we're going to be talking about Madden and the strange culture of Madden ratings and all of that. It'll be also hosted by the aforementioned Carl Bialik.
Yeah, a lot of Carl and, this
that's right. And John Boys from SB Nation, who writes Breaking Madden, will also be there. And it's called Varsity Letters. It'll be Monday, October 12th at 7:30 p.m. at Galerie Le Poisson Rouge.
Immaculate French.
In the village in New York. So check it out if you're around.
Okay, that'll do it for this week's show. Thanks to Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad.
Thanks to Neil Payne.
You're welcome, Chad.
Thanks to Jody Avergan, our podcast producer, and Ryan Nantel, our video producer. We get production assistance from Jordan Shulkin and Lois St. Jacques. Our intern is Sarah Patterson. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think about the podcast, about the NL wild card, about how we could have brought Carmelo to the fifth power. You know, should we have been wearing Carmelo jersey with our Carmelo shoes? You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and rate the show while you are there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.